Hello and welcome to another episode of PaleoCast. I'm Laura Soul, and it's actually just me this week because everybody else is off busy being busy. I did the interview as well, so you are going to hear a lot of my voice. Sorry about that. So in this episode, I'm talking to Tracy Ayes, who I actually met at Oxford because she was doing a postdoc there, working in the University Natural History Museum, but she's now actually moved in as a lecturer at the University of Leeds. So she studies planktonic foraminifera, which are tiny single-celled organisms, but they're really interesting and very useful for lots of different things, including, as Dave will tell you, the oil industry. But what Tracy researches is kind of two different things. So she uses them as a tool to understand macroevolution. We have a really great fossil record for them, so they're really good for figuring out when and why things might have gone extinct, or when and why they might speciate, and how that process actually occurs. And then the second thing that she really uses them for is understanding paleoclimate. So that's looking at the chemistry of the little shells that these organisms build around themselves to find out what ocean chemistry or temperatures were in the geological past. So it ended up being quite a long interview, so we'll do the first part this week, where I think we're mainly chatting about the macroevolution stuff and a bit about isotopes and how these things build their shells. And then if you enjoy this one, make sure that you tune in for the next episode next time, where we're talking much more about the climate stuff and really getting into the details of that. So yeah, as I said, I hope you enjoy it and make sure you listen to the next one as well. Who is lecturer in marine micropaleontology at the University of Leeds. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
So I guess, first of all, can you just tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into paleontology in the first place?
Well, I was a little bit convoluted because I actually started my university education studying fine art. And about halfway through, I realised that I wasn't really learning as much as I wanted to out of my degree. And so I swiftly changed my mind and I moved to Plymouth and did an extended science programme, which allowed people like myself who had A-levels in non-science related subjects to kind of bring themselves up to speed in the basic sciences, and with the view to allowing them to go on to a degree course in the science faculty at the University of Plymouth. And it was during that time that I was offered the opportunity to do a module in geosciences, and that's when I found an interest in geology and general paleontology.
So it was basically chance and luck rather than you loving fossils since you were a kid, like I think a lot of paleontologists say they do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I had really no interest in fossils as a child at all. I lived by the sea and I loved nature. But it wasn't like a lifelong ambition. I mean, I was probably one of those people who my only understanding of what a paleontologist was knowing that Ross from Friends was one of them. So that was it. And it was just really, what I was really interested in and why I wanted to go into science, having come from an art background, was I really wanted to understand how the world worked, how like systems, kind of natural systems operated. So that was my kind of real passion, and I did a lot of kind of expressing that interest in what I was doing with my art degree, and a lot of kind of interest in science was expressed through what I created, and then I realised that actually I just wanted to learn a bit more about that rather than kind of try and feel my way through the dark doing it on my own. So that's what inspired me to go and do a science degree. And in terms of micropaleontology, that was even more chance, because I was an undergraduate student and I was going to go and do my fieldwork mapping project, and 2 weeks before I was due to go on my fieldwork mapping project, like everybody has to if you want to get an accredited Jolsock degree, I fell over and broke my leg, and so I couldn't go, and I had to do a lab-based project instead, and I ended up working on microfossils And that's how I became a micropaleontologist.
Good story. So you're a micropaleontologist. So basically, in a general way, that means you study fossils that are very, very small.
Yeah, I'm not a really small paleontologist.
Tiny. But you have a specific focus of your research.
Yeah, so I am a micropaleontologist, but I work on a particular group called the planktonic foraminifera. And they are a group of single-celled organisms that live in our modern oceans, but have existed for over 150 million years. And they're very cosmopolitan, so they range from the poles to the equator. And they live in the upper water column, so in the surface waters near the photic zone, often hosting algal photosymbionts, and then down to much greater depths in the water column, and some species are found below the thermocline. And they are, as I said, single cell, and what they do is they make a hard calcium carbonate shell, and it's these shells that upon their death descend down to the water column and collect in ocean sediments that we as paleontologists are able to study.
So what do these things actually look like?
So they're very small, they're sub-millimetre in size, so if you want to actually look at the kind of shapes of their shells, you need to look at them under a microscope, otherwise they just look like white dust. But once you look at them under the microscope, they do have varying degrees of ornamentation, but I would say the simplest way to describe what a foraminifera looks like, a planktonic foraminifera looks like, is a tiny popcorn.
Okay.
So it's lots of little ball-like chambers that are all clustered together. And that's the hard parts. And then inside those hard parts, when the organism is alive, it has a cytoplasmic interior. And that cytoplasmic interior is inside the shell, but also in life, streams on the outside of the shell, and then has lots of little strands that go out into the water column all around it like a big net, which allows it to catch its food, which it then uses this net to draw the prey into the test and digest the organism. And then many species as well, interweaved in this what we call a rhizopodal network, have long thin calcite spines as well. So although they're very small, they have quite ornamented body shapes.
Do they live separately from each other, or do they?
Yes. Okay, so they are free floating, and they're individuals. Yeah, they are at the whim of the currents, so they don't form colonies or anything like that.
So you mentioned that it's the hard test shell around the organism that we find because it falls out of the water column into the sediment.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what the fossil record is like?
So because of the nature of their deposition, so they're obviously floating in the water column and then they rain down constantly on the deep sea. Because the deep sea is a very quiescent environment, what can happen is these, for millions of years, we can have these tiny little shells descending and settling on the seafloor, and they build up in what we call deep sea sediments. And this can allow you to have millions of years worth of unbroken evolutionary history of individual species. So what that means is that in terms of understanding a species, you not just have one skeleton, you have populations of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of specimens that can be collected from individual places, which allows you to get a really good and continuous record of a species history and with a whole body skeleton. So you have tons and tons of them.
So how long in the record, if you're looking at, how long would maybe like one species last for?
Oh, that's a really difficult question. So we have some really long-ranging species, which can last for like, well, there's some that we think maybe lasts for about 20 million years, some of our longest ranging species, and some which are very short ranging species and things we call excursion taxa, which only occur due to like specific climatic events and maybe exist for like 200,000 years.
And is it easy to tell that what you have is a continuous sequence of deposition in time and there aren't kind of gaps and things that are making it seem
familiar? It's not easy. But it is possible. So some of the things that we do to try and understand, one, sedimentation rates, and two, how continuous that is to look for something called isotope or magnetostratigraphy. So when we take cores up from the deep sea now, we can analyse certain properties in them, such as the oxygen isotopes of the sediments, or the magnetic polarity of the sediments, and we can get an understanding of how much time is in each core section. And then we can match that against known standards, and we can see whether we've got how much sediment is being deposited on average per year or per million years, which would be what we call creating an age model. And then once we've created that age model, we have the ability to understand how much of that is representing what we expect there to be there. So it's not non-trivial. It's not simple, but it's doable.
Okay.
And there are gaps in the record, and there are many cores where you'll have a continuous record which spans the entire Oligocene, and then all of a sudden we miss a big chunk of the Miocene and then go into the Pleistocene. And that, you know, that is part of deep sea sediments, but because we have the ability to drill in so many different places and pull up so many cores, we can basically patchwork together a continuous record from different sites.
Okay, and when you're looking at species and seeing, you know, how long they last for, where they are and things, how do you actually differentiate? Because these are very tiny organisms, and presumably some species are quite similar to one another.
Yeah, so they are, because obviously as a single cell, there's only so much you can do with your body.
Yeah.
And planktonic foraminifera are a kind of classic group to illustrate iterative evolution in terms of how they express their morphology. And there's a couple of key things that we look for, and one of the most important underlying characters that we look for in a planktonic foraminifera to distinguish which group it might belong to is its wall texture. So that's the kind of texture that the calcite wall has. But principally in the fossil record, we distinguish species of planktonic foraminifera from their morphology.
Okay.
And that is a combination of factors such as wall texture and test architecture and whether they have spines and how they build their shells.
Okay, so when they were alive, I guess there's the possibility that things that look incredibly similar that you would group together might have been slightly different in the cell within, but basically because you're looking at the fossil record, you kind of define things as morphospecies, and that's how you
understand
their evolution.
Absolutely. So there is a significant research effort at the moment in the foraminifera community with people sequencing modern day populations. And there is evidence of relatively significant cryptic species. So a number of different genetic types which could be identified to be one morphological species. But actually on closer inspection, we do find that some of those genetic distinct types do have very minor differences in stuff like shell porosity, so like how many pores and the distribution and size of those pores, that before we'd not really identified as a key character that you would maybe use to differentiate morpho species. But actually when you look at the populations that have been analysed for their genes, you do find that these genetic species sometimes have, you know, very subtle morphologic differences between them, which would allow you to kind of differentiate them. There are others that you can't do that with at all,
yeah.
And the cryptic species are actually cryptic. But then there are others where we see lineages of species that we know to have an integrating morpho species. We can actually identify a distinct single genetic lineage. So
okay.
they're a little bit complicated in terms of how we identify their species based on both genetic and morphologic information, but we only have morphologic information in the fossil record. There's no ability for us to derive any genetic information from them at all, so we work with what we have.
Yeah. When you say integrating, are you, by that do you mean you can actually kind of effectively see evolution happening through a lineage?
Yes. So because the record is so good, and because we have real fidelity with millions of years worth of history in individual places, what we can do is we can open a core and we can analyse successive populations, and we can take morphometric measurements of the species within them, and then we can run them through statistical packages which allow us to pull out clusters in multidimensional morphospace. And so what you can do basically is you can identify that sometimes there are species or populations of planktonic forams, and sometimes there'll be two populations of body shapes, And if you go back in time, you can see that they one will derive from the other, right. And that will be an integrating process. So the further you go back, the more similar they look, and then eventually you get to a point where they're all one type and you can't differentiate anything. So what we get is this ability to basically see a gradual evolutionary change in the body shapes of these populations, which then become statistically different enough in terms of their shape parameters from their ancestral forms, and then we know there's then we identify a speciation event.
Okay, so that work was a big part of what you did for your PhD.
Yeah.
And you built a phylogeny.
So a family tree.
Or a cladogram. So normally when we're sort of talking about phylogenies in the fossil record, divergence times between species when we are kind of guessed to a certain extent. So we try and time it based upon the fossil record. But with your phylogeny, is it the case that you could say with kind of a level of confidence that you actually know when these things diverged in time?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that's quite unique about our phylogeny. And it isn't a cladogram, it's a phylogeny.
Yeah.
So we... and the reason that it can work is A, because of the fossil record, but also because it's been extensively studied, and not just for evolutionary analyses, but they're an extremely important group for biostratigraphic purposes, which means that the ages of when things appear in the fossil record is something that people have worked on refining for a long time. So we use planktic foraminifera as biomarkers for, you know, key dates in biostratigraphy, and it's particularly important for some very economically important avenues, particularly the oil industry,
right.
Which is why there's been a lot of research effort into it.
Okay.
So we have quite a lot of confidence over our dates. I would say more so than many other groups could have.
Yeah.
And that's one, because the record allows you to have it, and two, because there's been this considerable research effort.
And is there a number, like a percentage, on how complete the
record is? Yes, there is.
Record is?
That's very interesting that you should ask that, Laura. So what we did when we completed our phylogeny is we did a completeness analysis. So what we wanted to do is for every branch length, which represents the duration of a species through time, we wanted to identify how much of that branch length was represented by a recorded fossil occurrence. So what we did is we binned time into 1 million year intervals. And for every 1 million year time bin that there was a recorded fossil occurrence in the Neptune database, we ticked that box.
Okay.
So all of those branch lengths were cut up into 1 million year intervals. And it turns out that from that analysis, 83.3% is our mean completeness. And 60% have a complete fossil record.
Okay.
So that only drops to like 57% if we cut into 1.5 million year time bins.
Okay.
So it's very complete.
Yeah.
Okay. And the Neptune database, I should add, is a database of all recorded fossil occurrences from IODP, ODP and DSDP voyages. So that's the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program.
Okay.
And it has a ship called the JR and another one called the Chicxulub. And they go out and they drill up all our deep sea sediments. And you have biostratigraphers, four-round biostratigraphers on the ship who are constantly cutting out segments of those cores that are coming up, and they're identifying the populations within them and dating the rocks. So you know how old those sediments are based on the fossils that are in them. That information is then fed into the Neptune database and is available for access. So it's actually a really conservative estimate, because obviously they're not looking at the entire core, they're looking at sections from 1.5 kilometer cores. They're doing as much as they can. And they're only identifying things that are really easy and obvious. Like, so some people do identify everything, other people identify the key things that are necessary, and yet we still get 83.3% mean completeness.
Yeah. I don't know what the exact numbers are for the kinds of fossils I look at, but it's probably much less than 1%, just to put that into perspective.
And that's not even just a recorded occurrence either, that's a whole body skeleton.
Yeah.
So you're not just looking at a part in a 1 million year time bin, you're No, or a tooth. You're looking at the whole organism's skeleton.
Okay, so you have this amazing data set and this real phylogeny.
Uh-huh.
What key things have you learnt about kind of the process of evolution from looking at this?
So we did some analysis, and this was in collaboration with my colleagues, Tom Ezard, who is a lecturer at the University of Southampton, Professor Paul Pearson at the University of Cardiff, and Professor Andy Purvis, who was at Imperial College and is now at the Natural History Museum. And we did some analysis on the phylogeny to look at the influence of various different factors on the likelihood of speciation and the likelihood of extinction. So we wanted to know what was kind of driving the overall like macroevolutionary dynamics of the clade through time. So we set it against the backdrop of Jim Zachos's global climate change curve. So the oxygen, benthic oxygen isotope stack of the last 65 million years, which tells us how climate's changed over the Cenozoic. And we looked at we mapped the phylogeny against that. And what we did is we identified certain ecological traits and morphological traits that were like innovations and like could be used to categorise all of our different species. And we looked at the influence of a few things, and that was, one was diversity dependence, two was species age, three was changing climate, and D was species ecology, so, and how those things interrelated. And we found that extinction is more strongly influenced by changes in climate and the ecology of the species, whereas the converse is true for speciation, and the likelihood of speciation is more dependent on diversity or diversity dependence within the clade.
What exactly does that mean?
How many species there are any one time.
Right.
Which kind of supports an early burst model. So the clade is very interesting and very good for doing macroevolutionary analyses because it's monophyletic, which means that everything that's in the clade roots to a single common ancestor, which was from the Cretaceous. And at the KT boundary, only two species of planktonic foraminifera crossed the boundary.
So that was when the dinosaurs went extinct?
Yeah. So it had that extinction event had a massive impact on the planktonic foraminifera, who before then were an extremely abundant, diverse clade with lots of different interesting ornate forms. Nearly everything went extinct, apart mm-hmm. from these two very small, quite boring shaped planktonic foraminifera, the Hedbergellids, one which was derived from the other. And they went on to found the Cenozoic clade, so the 400 odd species that we see today, all derived from this single common ancestor, which allows us to do lots of really interesting macroevolutionary analyses because we know that everything that we're looking at roots from a single source.
So you mentioned early burst model. What does that actually mean?
So basically, there's this idea that if you've got a lot of available like eco space or niche space, then a group will fill it.
Right, so lots of new species will evolve to
very quickly.
To take
up. Yeah, and that's, you kind of see that in the planktonic foraminifera after the KT boundary. So only two species cross the boundary, and then within a very short space of time, you've founded the lineages to all of the major clades that continue throughout the rest of the Cenozoic.
Right.
And there's a pretty swift recovery. Within like 5 million years, you've got quite a rich population already.
Okay, so you see this really fast increase in diversity at the beginning and then it plateaus?
Yeah, so we plateau at about 60 morpho species, is what appears to be the kind of maximum that we can support in our global oceans at any one time. That's
right.
Morpho species.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we get a kind of maxima in terms of diversity in the Eocene, so it was one of our greenhouse climates.
Yeah, and so has it declined since then?
So yeah, we've had a couple of like key events that have knocked out or pruned the tree. So the EO boundary, the Eocene-Oligocene boundary, when we see the onset of glaciation in Antarctica,
mm-hmm.
that was quite a significant extinction event for the planktonic foraminifera, and we lost quite a lot of more ornate forms with very kind of specific ecologic niches. And then the pattern of diversity has kind of risen and fallen throughout time with these few key events throughout the last 65 million years. And then we are hovering around 45 morpho species in the modern ocean.
So we've already talked a little bit about understanding climate using these things. Mm-hmm. And really what you do is kind of a cross between paleobiology and paleoclimatology.
Yeah.
What's the process of using forams to... Can you reconstruct past climate looking at forams, and what information do you need to get from them to be able to do that?
Mm. So yeah, this... one of the reasons why planktic forams are such a widely studied group and why they're so useful is because they are essentially little windows into past climates. Because what they do is they milk their hard calcium carbonate shell in equilibrium with the surrounding waters, and certain fractionation processes, so the way in which they incorporate certain elements into their shells,
mm-hmm.
can be affected by abiotic factors such as temperature. So the way in which a planktonic foraminifera incorporates oxygen isotopes into its shell is essentially affected by kind of a number of things, but kind of two key things that we investigate with it is, one, understanding what the temperature is at the time, because that's a temperature dependent fractionation, and two, how much ice there is on the planet. Because the relative proportions of the different oxygen isotopes can be affected by how much ice there is, because of the way in which we fractionate oxygen isotopes from our oceans into clouds. So the lighter oxygen isotope preferentially gets removed, because mm-hmm. it's kinetically easier to remove a lighter isotope than it is a heavier one. And then if that's transported via global weather patterns to the poles,
yeah.
as a lot of the moisture from the tropics is transported north, if that precipitates out in the north and gets locked up as ice, you relatively enrich the tropical seas, the low latitude seas, in the heavier isotope. So we can look for that signal in the isotope record of planktic foraminifera, and we can also look for the influence of temperature on the way in which the oxygen isotopes have been incorporated into their shell. So we basically get out of value, which mm-hmm. is a number, and the more negative that number is, the hotter it is.
Okay.
And the more positive that number is, the colder it is.
So can you do this on kind of all of the record?
Yes.
So for any point in time, you can get this number out and get
you can. You have to be slightly careful, because one of the things that has become increasingly apparent over the last 30 years, I would say 15 years really, with some of the work that has been done by Paul Pearson, working on really well-preserved planktonic foraminifera, is that there can be a overprinting or a recrystallization effect. So you have to be careful that when you're using planktonic foraminifera material, you know that it isn't recrystallized, because otherwise you're not going to be getting a primary oxygen isotope signal. So that's important. So
okay.
Not all of the record will give you a reliable result. However, all of the record can give you a value.
Okay.
It's whether you should trust that value or not. But if you go for well-preserved, or what we call glassy planktonic foraminifera, so ones that haven't been subject to post-depositional recrystallization, then you can be pretty confident that you're getting a primary signal.
Okay, and how do you translate that oxygen isotope number, sort of negative or positive one that you get out, into a temperature?
So we use various paleotemperature equations, which are based on our understanding of how planktonic foraminifera build their shells based on laboratory cultures, and also experiments looking at the precipitation of inorganic calcite and how that's affected by different temperature settings. So it's all based on laboratory calibrations mm-hmm. and core top calibrations, so where we know the temperature of the modern day oceans and where the planktonic foraminifera are calcifying. We then get the sediments from the very surface of the ocean, we analyse those, and we can get a relationship between what that temperature is and what the oxygen isotope value is. And then if we take the living planktic forams out of the ocean and put them in laboratory settings where we adjust the temperature, we can see how that affects the oxygen isotopes, and we've basically been able to derive calibrations based on that. And based on those calibrations, we have oxygen isotope paleotemperature equations, and that's how we do it.
Okay, so there's a huge amount of work that's gone into it in the modern day and in the lab to calculate
Absolutely.
These equations specifically.
It all goes back to, I suppose, two key people, really. The first being a guy called Harold Urey, who was a very famous scientist who worked on the Manhattan Project during World War II and had done a lot of work in isotope systems and understanding hydrogen isotopes in order to be used for military purposes. And at the end of the war, he applied a lot of his knowledge about understanding the hydrogen isotope system to understanding oxygen isotopes. And he discovered that there was a relationship between the way in which oxygen isotopes fractionated from water into carbonates, and that there was a temperature dependency for that. And then years later, another guy called Cesare Emiliani came and worked in Harold Urey's lab, and together, and really pioneered by Emiliani, was the idea of using oxygen isotopes as paleoceanographic indicators of temperature systems.
Cool.
Yeah.
Important guy.
He was a very cool guy, very smart guy, and he is the eponymous Emiliani of Emiliani Huxleyi, one of the most important global clockolithophores.
That
when
you
look at the Earth from when you look at pictures of the Earth from space and you see those big green blooms, that's generally Emiliani Huxleyi, and that's genus is named after him.
Cool.
Yeah.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.